So then, leaving already. When it comes to the practice of relying upon a spiritual friend or a guru, a teacher, there should be some precedent. Here, at the outset, I'd like to stress that there's nobody's forcing the hand of a student. Indeed, if any teacher says, "Oh, you should be my disciple," then there is kind of room for doubt about the motivation of the prospective teacher. And one thing that I'd like to make clear from the beginning is that with regard to relying upon a spiritual teacher, and the only reason we have to kind of give this warning in advance is because of the way that this abuse of power has continued, not only in recent years in the West, in Asia, but also in the past as well. We can read numerous accounts of people who abused a particular position. But the question then is, well, if they're going to abuse such a position, how did they get there in the first place? Well, we've all seen politicians rise, come to power, and then completely go back on everything they first set out to accomplish, haven't we? And similarly, if a so-called spiritual teacher is not purely motivated, but rather is motivated by what's known as kind of worldly pursuits. Worldly pursuits here then means an obsession with acquiring kind of material gain, praise, kind of flattery, and is frightened of losing said acquisitions. Motivated purely thereby, anybody can, you know, do anything. Some people can kind of make good business, some people can make a black market, and some people can, in the guise of being a spiritual teacher, engage in all manner of activities in order to gain some kind of acquisition. So this is not something new, this is not something unique to the Western world, this is not something unique to kind of Asians taking advantage of people in the Western world. This is something that happened, for example, in around the 11th century. We read of the Bengali master Atisha going to Tibet. And at the time, there were a number of people known as the kind of Acharya Blue Skirts, as they were known. And it was a particular group of Indians who basically kind of dressed up as kind of very outlandish-looking kind of spiritual teachers, and then went into kind of the villages and kind of little hamlets of southern Tibet, and basically said, "We're great kind of Vajra masters. We're kind of enlightened Buddhas in human form. Now please give us your kind of money, your possessions, your daughters, and you can kind of worship us for a while before we move on." And people did that. And the reason was because they didn't know any better. At the time, there was a kind of great revival of Buddhism in Tibet, and there was the floodgates of masters coming in from India were open, and some were authentic and some weren't. As such, where does the fault lie with that kind of relationship? Rather, it is from the side of the student. One has allowed oneself to be kind of manipulated and taken advantage of. So how do we make sure that, as a genuine kind of spiritual seeker, somebody wishing to bring about an inner transformation, how do we make sure that we don't run foul of, or that we don't come into contact with such individuals? Now here, there's no guarantee, just because we have the intention not to run into a charlatan, that it's not going to happen. So then you may say, if it's so dangerous, what can we do to kind of protect ourselves? What kind of armor can we wear to protect ourselves and to make sure that we are not taken advantage of? And the simple answer to this is to use one's intelligence. Now, I'm pretty sure that all of us in this room have had some degree of higher education. Probably out of all of us here, I'm the least educated, having dropped out of high school. But nevertheless, we all have an understanding of what's right and what's wrong, and we all have, to some degree, kind of common sense. And as such, what is imperative is when we come to something that is new to us. For example, when we want to, you know, practice something kind of spiritual, what is imperative is to look beyond the facade, look beyond what is presented to you. And here it's essential then to use one's intellect and one's analysis of judging the person who is seemingly offering or proffering a particular spiritual pursuit to you. One of my close friends and teachers, Kenbuishi Gyaltsen, he and I, we go to Southeast Asia every year. And in this part of the world, you're relatively protected because you don't have so many teachers passing through. Whereas in Southeast Asia, for example, in Malaysia, Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Indonesia to a lesser degree, and Thailand, therein one finds kind of established Buddhist cultures. And also we find an extreme lack of intelligence when it comes to investigating the teaching which is being kind of proffered. So therein you find all kinds of fake teachers. Now for Kenobushe and myself, we are we lived in Tibetan communities in Nepal and India, and we have very strong kind of links with Tibet, and we know kind of what's going on and who's who. And so when we come to these kind of shopping, there they have these kind of shopping arcades, like a shopping mall, which is full of shops. And Chinese people generally like kind of trinkets, powerful stones like various kind of crystals and other semi-precious stones and images of this, that and the other, you know. They're very much into this kind of thing, feng shui stuff, you know, this kind of geometry. And so there's a whole, in Singapore, for example, there's this supermarket which is full of this stuff. And, you know, if any of you have ever been to India or Nepal, you'll know that the quality of the merchandise in the shop is, you know, maybe out of 10, 2 at a push. It's not very good. But you know, the amusing thing for Kenbuchi and I when we go there is to look at the kind of billboards in front of the notice boards in front of the shops. And you see all these kind of fake teachers. And they're all, you know, in general, this is changing slightly, but in general, in Southeast Asia, particularly in the Chinese communities and lesser, but nevertheless prevalent in Indonesian and Thai communities, people don't want to be told, think about this, have a think about it. They rather say, please give me a blessing. But what's that? Please give me like a trinket or something that will protect me from whatever, and you know, it will somehow kind of act as a magnet which will draw in all this kind of wealth to me. And this is the kind of aptitude of a Southeast Asian person, generally. They have a lot of devotion to the teaching of Buddha, and in particular to then Tibetan Buddhism, because that merges two things. One is the indigenous Buddhist culture, but it makes it more alive, it's more colourful. And as such, you have people coming in doing something which we've never heard of before, you know, in the Tibetan community, like grand vase blessing super puja. And basically, it's, yeah, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you do have these particular kind of, you know, vases for doing this and that, you know, but they're usually used for a particular purpose, like in a build, putting under a house or something, and it's to, or putting under a monastery when you construct it, and it's to attract kind of good circumstance. That's what it's for. But then that's been twisted over the years by unscrupulous people, and it's become wealth gathering vase. And the idea is you buy one of these and you put it in your room, and whew, or the lottery, you know, you don't even have to buy the ticket, it kind of blows in through your letterbox. So this is the kind of abuse which has gone on over the years. But nevertheless, it's become kind of established, such that when Kempoman, I go there, and Kenpoche teaches the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, and Buddhism in general, and the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life in particular. And in general, there's two kind of people. One is like, why doesn't he give empowerments? Why doesn't he do some kind of rituals for money? Why doesn't he do some kind of healing puja? And Kenpoche said, you know, very clearly right from the beginning, my wish is that there be some of you here that become genuinely learned in then the Tibetan presentation of Mahayana Buddhism, so as to kind of remove this kind of superstition which has become somewhat set in the populace. But people don't really, not really interested in that. And if you're not interested in that, fair enough. But that brings us to us, because we're standing at a juncture where two things are being presented to us. One is kind of a genuine kind of spiritual path and pursuit, and the other is maybe one which is something other than that. Now, it's essential, as I said, to look beyond the kind of packaging. And how do we kind of go about looking beyond what is a prophet or what is presented to us? It's by really going back or kind of turning our minds inward. What do we want from then the kind of present moment? For some reason or another, we've come to the notion or the idea that we would like some kind of peace of mind, possibly, and independence thereupon, some kind of development of ourselves, and we assure that, to some extent at least, that we can get that through the practice of Buddhism, through kind of knowing it, contemplating it, and then through meditating upon it. We have the ability then to build a kind of stable foundation, and thereupon kind of practice in a very systematic way, one which will kind of elucidate or will bring about then a kind of a solid or a lasting kind of change within us. As such, when different types of teachers come before us, the question then is, what should we be looking for in that particular individual? Do we want something like a kind of short-term fix, which is like going to see a Tibetan, saying something in Tibetan, playing some kind of musical instruments, and giving us a kind of bop on the head, and then giving us a bill for maybe, you know, 10,000 shekels? Or, on the other hand, would we like to kind of visit with a teacher that's not perhaps so kind of fancy on the outside, but is able to kind of give us advice that we're able to then internalize and to bring about some kind of a change within ourselves? And this ultimately then rests with us. It is our kind of it is our choice. Now, I'm not saying one is better than the other, one is right, one is wrong. These are just different scenarios for different people. Of course, if I was to choose one personally, when I started becoming interested in Buddhism when I was 16, 17 in England, at that time there weren't many teachers around, particularly where I live in the south of England. And so we had to revert to books. Then we would read the book and we would think about the meaning of what was proffered to us in the book. And thereby we would kind of gain an idea of the general teaching of the Buddha, and in particular about the notion of going from this kind of contaminated experience, which is known as samsara, purifying or exhausting that, and experiencing that which is other than it, or nirvana. So all these ideas started to kind of take a hold of one's mind, or my mind in this case, and thereby the interest in the subject matter kind of deepens. And then, as for the kind of digesting of the subject, how do we actually do it? Then it rather takes a long time to seek out somebody who is able to actually kind of give that to me in this case. So it took about 4 or 5 years before I found somebody who was able to give this kind of instruction, so as the teaching became alive. But in that 5-year period, then I still bought many books, read many books, discussed kind of Dharma with many friends in Japan, where I was living at the time, and also in a little bit to some Western friends as well. And as such, where the kind of cookie crumbles for me is then the notion of spiritual transformation. And whether that's the same for you, I have no idea. But in general, in terms of genuine kind of a Buddhist practice, this is the kind of party line. As such, the Buddha, after realizing enlightenment, or kind of after, according to the etymology of the word Buddha, after waking up, the Buddha then went to a place called Sarnath, a place called Deer Park, and there he met his five friends. And these five friends were kind of sadhus. And when they met him, at first they thought, "Nah, Siddhartha, useless guy, is not doing ascetic practice any longer." But when he approached them, he said that his appearance was such that, his countenance was such that they naturally kind of changed their mind and laid out a nice seat, sat him down, and as in the Indian kind of tradition, they kind of bathed his feet, gave him something to drink, and then said, "You look different. Something's happened. Please tell us what it is." And then he gave his first teaching. And this is the pivotal teaching for all kind of Buddhists. And in fact, it is said that if anything is a genuine Buddhist teaching, it can be fit within this outline of the four truths. So when the Buddha gave the teaching of the four truths, he was not only lecturing, but rather was talking from his experience. And as such, he was somebody endowed with quality, somebody who had kind of the highest quality, because he'd realized these four truths, particularly then the ultimate expression of the third, or the ultimate cessation based upon his own experience. As such, he was heavy with that particular quality. Heavy with a spiritual quality, then, is the meaning of the Sanskrit word guru. Somebody who's heavy with spiritual quality. When that is translated into Tibetan as lama, there's two particles, la and ma. La refers then to highest. Ma is one endowed with. So one endowed with the highest kind of spiritual realization is then someone who is given the title of lama. It also can mean one possessed of or endowed with the kind of highest qualities. But in any way, in any whichever way we like to look at it, it means somebody who has some rather heavy, you might say, spiritual experience. Now, what is then is the result of that experience is, of course, there's the internal transformation, but then there is also then the method of passing this experience on to others. As such, the Buddha, Siddhartha, gave his first teaching, whereas he told his disciples, in essence, that all experience is in the nature of dukkha. So whatever that may be, whether it be pleasant or unpleasant, very lavish or very ascetic, whatever experience one has is in the nature, is dukkha. And dukkha means, it's often translated as suffering, but the meaning here really is that whatever the experience is, be it physical or mental, it is not enduring. It doesn't last. And as such, is unable to deliver any ultimate or enduring kind of satisfaction. As such, it is in the nature of dukkha, which is ultimately dissatisfying. And now pretty much I would imagine that these sadhus are aware of that. Because they just spent, 8 or 9 years of their lives living ascetic practices with the idea to kind of exhaust the contaminant, which is the world, which is somehow inherent in their being, and as such to kind of torture themselves to a point where you kind of go beyond the gross kind of level of mind, and also then the physical, to go beyond it through then putting yourself through aesthetic practices, such as starving yourself, or this practice known as the five fires, where you sit, you know, in the midday sun with, of course, that's hot in and of itself, isn't it? But then with a fire in front of you, a fire behind, a fire to either side. And you still see this nowadays in India, people trying to kind of rid themselves of dukkha through these ascetic practices. Nowadays, of course, the fire fires happens, but not, you know, not in the kind of public view. But also, what that we do see, people don't sit down for years. People kind of tie their arm up in the head like this, and it kind of starts to rot away and things like this. These kind of ascetic practices, we see, we can observe them, particularly if you go to the Indian city of Varanasi, you can see this type of thing in abundance there. But nevertheless, the Buddha then mentioned that whatever you do, it's only going to lead to dukkha. And you need to understand that this dukkha has a particular cause. It's not inherent within our being. It's rather brought about in dependence upon a cause. There's a reason for it. And the third thing he then went on to say is, but it doesn't have to be like that. It can stop. In other words, you can have that which is beyond or other than the experience of dukkha. You can have that experience. And then the question then is, well, how? And because there is a particular method, a particular path, particular meditation that you can do that will bring about this kind of cessation or this stopping. As such, then the Buddha, when he gave his first teaching, his disciples at the time were spiritual seekers. There was something within them that said, I want to go beyond the kind of mundane. I want to go beyond it. And what is the way of doing that? Maybe it is through these ascetic practices. Maybe it's through, you know, kind of a self kind of a torture. Maybe it's through this kind of masochistic tendencies. As such, you find many people in India, in ancient India, and even today, who on some degree recognize that experience does not bring about any enduring satisfaction. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't pleasant situations. There are. There are satisfying, you know, experiences. You know, when we eat some nice food, for example, or have a kind of cold drink on a hot day, and vice versa. These do bring us some satisfaction. But if we are mindful, remember I mentioned to you how useful it is to be mindful. Mindful in switching off your phone. Obviously failed there. How useful it is to be mindful at all times and in all situations. Well, when we go beyond just being mindful into the actual kind of digesting process, the contemplation of the Buddhist teaching, here then, if we are mindful of all situations, we get to see firsthand the dukkha nature of things. We can enjoy things to the max because we're not distracted, and we can really enjoy whatever it may be that we enjoy, whether it be in a sandwich, whether it be in a whatever, particular kind of tea or particular coffee, juice, whatever. We can enjoy it in the moment, but within that mindfulness of the experience, we can, the anticipation of taking it, we can then partake of the drink, or whatever, food, whatever, experience, and then we know it's going to fade away, and we're not going to cling to that, because we know it's its nature. If we're able to do that, just as, for example, in the mindfulness practice that we've done together, when we observe experience, particularly thought, you'll remember, or physical sensation, feeling, when it arises in our being, we just observe it, recognize it, acknowledge it, and then just let it go. The same then when it comes to the practice of mind, being mindful of one's day-to-day life, whatever, when mindfulness becomes strong therein, whatever experience we have, we observe it, simply do that, recognize, acknowledge, and then let it go. Thereby, we do not become fettered by or bound to hankering after or desiring of some kind of enduring pleasure. So the benefit of this, what is that, you may wonder? The benefit of this is such that when things do not go the way we want it to, or when we lose something which is dear to us, then we just recognize this as the play of contaminated existence. Now this is rather like accepting an illness. For example, if we go to a hospital and we're told we have a particular type of illness that will require an operation, or at least taking some kind of medication in order to bring us back to health, I don't think any of us would hesitate. We would rather say, yes, please give me that, a particular operation or medication or what have you. I want to be well again. So otherwise, the only other way of dealing with the situation is just to say, you're very ill. Oh, okay. Do you want to do something about it? No. I don't think anybody would have that kind of reaction as such. As an individual, if we're then told that every experience you have is dukkha. Now, like an illness, this is not inherent in you, otherwise you'd have been ill from birth with the same kind of malignant kind of illness. Now, this is something which has come about through that kind of gene mutating, through kind of eating a contaminated, you know, samosa or whatever, through a particular condition, an illness has arisen in us. As such, it's not a part of us. Although at the moment of undergoing the illness, we are ill as such. We are under the influence of this kind of illness. I am ill. I am ill. I feel ill. It's as if the illness is one with us. But if we, with introspection, if we look at ourselves, we'll see that the illness that we're experiencing is not a part of who we are. It's rather come about because of a particular condition. Now maybe we don't recognize that illness at first, and as such we go to a doctor and we say, something's wrong. And the doctor then takes some blood, maybe gives us a kind of physical examination, then puts the two together and says, oh, you're suffering from this particular illness. And then it's almost like a relief, because now we know what the problem is. It's been kind of clearly indicated to us. And then the doctor, not directly, no doctor will say, oh, it's come about because of this cause. They'd rather say, you have this illness, okay, now let's get rid of it. So that implies that the illness is not a part of who we are, but rather we are experiencing it because of a particular condition. Again, what this also implies is that we can stop, or we can remove, we can get rid of this illness. So going back to what I was mentioning before, the Buddha is kind of renowned as the supreme physician, not because he heals the body, but rather in terms of the body and mind composite, the main focus is upon the mind and its manifestations, whether they be kind of physical sensations, thoughts or experiences, or not only a kind of one time or one lifetime kind of level, but rather on the whole continuum of mind itself. And as such then, the Buddha has said to his disciples, the kind of suffering that you know about, this kind of dukkha nature of things, comes about in dependence upon a cause. It can be stopped, and there's a way of doing that, which is like saying, the reason why you're feeling a little bit sick is because you have a jhadiya. Do you know jhadiya? It's a particular illness you get in Asia. It's very, very upsetting. It makes you very bloated and very, very uncomfortable. Anyway, jhadiya, because pretty much everyone gets it during the monsoon at some point or another. So the bloating and everything, the discomfort you are feeling, is caused by jhadiya. Here is some medicine called Ayurvedic medicine called amati, that will cure you. Within that kind of discussion with the doctor, even though it may be only kind of minuscule in terms of the kind of duration of one's life, few moments, what you learn is that the illness is not a part of you. Rather, it's come about because of a particular cause. And as such, if you take the antidote thereto, its kind of fruition, the kind of feeling of the illness, and the kind of and the feelings of illness and bloatedness and that discomfort that it brings about can be removed. Now, if we are feeling kind of ill, we are feeling kind of a little bit kind of down, to the extent that we go to see a doctor with our intellect, with our common sense, we're going to see a doctor, we're not going to see a quack, yeah? We're going to see somebody who is a genuine physician, who will give us genuine advice, and we'll take that advice and kind of do it as much as possible, take whatever kind of compound he or she gives us, actually doing exactly what the person said, because we want to be free of this experience, this kind of discomfort. And when we consider just a cold or a flu or a minor illness, still, nevertheless, we would seek out the advice and the counsel of a genuine doctor, and similarly, we would only partake of genuine kind of medicines in order, because we want to protect ourselves, whether we are fully conscious of that or whether it's subconscious feeling within us. Of course, we want to protect ourselves from further dissatisfaction, further illness. So this attitude of trusting genuine kind of doctor and only partaking of a genuine medicines, genuine kind of remedies, is something we are used to, and it is something that we need to apply to our kind of relationship with spiritual friends and spiritual kind of teachers. And here is where it gets rather tricky, because on one level we are very used to kind of going to a doctor and kind of completely giving ourselves to the doctor in some ways. That is to say, we trust them implicitly, and we're going to do what they advise us because we trust them. Similarly then, with a spiritual teacher, when we have a feeling of kind of this dukkha nature, because that is the nature of the contaminated existence that is samsara, this is not something that needs to be kind of dwelled upon, but it is something that through using our alertness and introspection, if we kind of just existentially reflect upon our experience, we'll see that nothing endures therein. Now, some people say, well, maybe that's the delight of change. Maybe I like change, they'll say. And they'll be very happy saying, what you say is that utter nonsense. Dissatisfaction doesn't exist. Only the satisfaction of change exists. And they'll argue that point kind of very well. But we all know in our experience that things don't go the way we want them to. And when things kind of in the delight of change go from good to bad, then of course there is upset, there is pain, there is dissatisfaction. This is not something that we are, you know, that we are hiding from. It's just part of contaminated life. It's part of the life that we know at the present moment. And this, again, is not something that the Buddha kind of said to his disciples, believe me. Rather, he said, all is suffering, all is dukkha. And in the second recitation of the Four Noble Truths, because he said the four of them three times, in the second recitation, he said, you must know dukkha. You know what it is. How do you know what it is? Well, initially this feeling of dissatisfaction, if we kind of think about it, it's not quite right, and it kind of starts to eat away at us. We should know that experientially. We know that experience for ourselves. And then, in the third kind of recitation of these Four Noble Truths, the Buddha then said, this is what is to be gotten rid of. This is the illness, jadia, cancer, hepatitis, whatever varieties of illness we can talk about. This is what we're going to get rid of. As such, the Buddha then said, so if I can remember, everything is in the nature of dukkha. Dukkha has a cause. There is a cessation, and there is a path. Now, path, spiritual path here means then the actual method and realization of that which removes kind of dukkha and places us in nirvana, if you will. He then went on to say, recognize dukkha, your own, recognize it for yourself. Don't believe just what I've said because I've said it. This echoes the famous quotation from the sutras within which the Buddha says to his disciples, don't just kind of believe what I say blindly. Think about it for yourself. This is what I'm kind of stating through my experience. But you need to kind of come to this conclusion yourself. I'm only kind of putting you in a particular direction. So investigate what I have to say, rather like a sensible goldsmith will investigate a lump of yellow stuff that is offered to him as gold. He's going to cut it, burn it, and rub it to make sure that it's genuine. Similarly then, with regard to kind of a spiritual teaching, it's essential then to investigate what it is, how it relates to us, before meditating upon it. As such, contemplation, which we discussed yesterday, becomes ever more important. Because it can be stopped, and there is the method that it can be stopped, because there is a method or the spiritual realization or path which leads to that cessation or kind of stopping. And then finally, the truth of suffering, dukkha is that which is to be abandoned by severing its cause. One is to experience the stopping of this kind of dukkha, and by taking up or by kind of coming to a definitive conclusion through contemplation on the various kinds of the various forms of vipassana or higher seeing, and through bringing them into reality through one's kind of meditative experience. As such, then one is to experience the path. Now, the Buddha spoke this from his experience. Nobody taught this to him. This was the result or the outcome of his experience. And as such, when we go to a doctor, it's along the same vein. The illness is pointed out, and then indirectly that we know that the illness is not a part of who we are. We know it can be stopped if we listen to what the doctor says. Now, the point here is that the doctor, genuine doctor, is going to give us a very good diagnosis, and that helps clarify certain points. But in addition thereto, the doctor is also going to prescribe a remedy. He's going to give us a prescription. And we're going to take a genuine medicine, and we're going to make sure this medicine is, not past the sell-by date. In India, this is a big concern of ours. And we're going to then take this with an idea of getting better. As such, we take this back further to then the spiritual aspirant. In a genuine level, well, on any level, there is a notion of kind of dissatisfaction. Now, whether this be kind of a haunting one, like the kind of five kind of sadhus, or the five kind of good disciples, as they're known, who had an understanding of the kind of dukkha nature of things, and they wanted to get rid of it. But they didn't know who the genuine doctor was, and as such they relied upon quacks who had given them, in light of the Buddha's teaching, in light of the logical analysis, a kind of a partial or a kind of fake remedy, like kind of green water that you see in the kind of Western films, when the quack rolls into town selling green water as the kind of a universal panacea, which is going to cure every ailment. So they've been given something like that. And as such, they were torturing themselves, rather bringing about more kind of dukkha needlessly. As such, when the Buddha gave them the kind of the method, then they were primed to have that experience straight away, because all of the kind of dominoes were in place, and it was just the first knock that brought this kind of spiritual realization about. Because within the kind of Indian tradition, the notion of cause and effect, the notion of the kind of separation of body and mind, the notion of the causal continuum of mind, etc., is all standard fare. Whereas for us, it's something that needs to be kind of worked on. As such, within kind of samsara, there are various forms of dukkha, some more extreme than the others. As Ayadeva in his Madhyamika treatise, the 400 stanzas, mentions that the poor kind of look up at the rich and think, if only I were rich, then I'd be really happy. Whereas the rich look down at the kind of simple village life of the poor and say, I wish I could give all of this up and go and live down there simply in the village. And the point Ayadeva is making is that wherever we find ourselves, whatever situation we find ourselves in, it has its own peculiar kind of dukkha experience. So whether we're very rich, whether we're very poor, whether we're monastic, whether we're a householder, each scenario has its own kind of unique kind of a dukkha experience. Similarly, you know, whether we're kind of Israeli, whether we're English, American, it has its own kind of particular, you know, dukkha experience, its own kind of dukkha baggage, if you will. So as such, we can, in one sense, remaining within the kind of dukkha experience of samsara, as it's known, we can then possibly seek out somebody who is not able to cure us, but is able to kind of give us a sedative that will somewhat alleviate the pain. Now, whether that person is genuine or not, it makes no kind of difference. In the ultimate analysis, this kind of remedy is only going to give a kind of partial alleviation of the dukkha experience, and it will nevertheless mutate further into the kind of dukkha experience. That is, for example, like going to the spiritual teacher and saying, please give me one of these special vases which magnetizes all the kind of lottery numbers to me so that I can be really rich, and then I'll be kind of really happy. And let's say, for example, somebody's living a simple life with their kind of family, and this is not, you know, this is not something made up. There's a survey in the UK, because we have, I don't know, you probably have the same thing here, as a kind of national lottery. So we have lots of these things in Europe now, and in England in particular, all these different kinds of lotteries. And some of them, like the other week, I think my father said it was 180 million euros. Imagine that. And what happens is, there was a survey done for people who'd won this money. And more often than not, within a couple of years, all the money's gone. And the person is in kind of therapy because they're suicidal from depression. And this is not a one-off kind of one-off. This is the general kind of generally what happens when you win the lottery. I think there was one kind of exception, and this was a man who was a medical student, and he really kind of, everyone thought he was an idiot, because he basically said when he won the lottery, he said, £8 or £9 million or something like that. And they said, are you going to retire? He was about 26, 27, something like that. And he said, no. I've all my life, my best friend and I, we grew up together. We both wanted to be doctors to help people. And so what I've done is, from the money I won, I kind of paid off my student loan, and I paid off my best friend's student loan. So we're going to graduate without any debt. And then I put a little bit of money aside, maybe £100,000, to buy a small apartment. And then I give the rest of the money to Doctors Without Borders. And they said, well, that's madness. He said, no, it's not. This is, following that kind of money is madness, because my dream's always been to be a doctor. And so then this just allows me to kind of get out of this kind of heavy burden of student loan. It supports doctors I really appreciate, that I'd like to kind of that I would like to follow, and it gives me the opportunity to do that. And it was in the kind of tabloids in the UK. There was kind of people laughing at this guy. What an idiot, you know, giving away all this money. But in the documentary I saw, years later, this guy was so happy at being a doctor. He'd done kind of incredible work with this money, which just kind of lifted him up. And he was a very, very successful doctor, kind of traveling around and alleviating kind of pain. Whereas people who were laughing at him, other lottery winners, they were all in kind of therapy for depression. And so, again, when it comes to the dukkha experience, that which we may take as the panacea to alleviate our kind of manifest kind of dukkha, like gadgets and a lot of money, etc., and vice versa, kind of getting rid of the particular kind of gross artifact or the gross kind of thing which is causing our dukkha in the moment. By getting rid of it, it's just going to bring about another experience of dukkha. Because this is then the scenario we're in, within which every experience, and this is the point, every experience is in the nature of dukkha then. It's unable to bring about any lasting lasting experience of satisfaction, any lasting satisfaction. As such, the Buddha, the reason for this is because on a very, very gross level, because everything is in the nature of change. If it wasn't in the nature of change, the experience would remain the same without changing. It would be a permanent experience. And as such, that in and of itself would be something really boring and in the nature of dukkha. Yeah. As such, it's in the nature of change. But the problem comes on a basal level because we don't want to let go of the kind of experiences we like, and we want to force away or push away the experiences that we that we don't like. And again, this is not something I'm requesting you to believe or I'm telling you to believe. Rather, this is something which can be investigated. Just as, for example, we have a notion of who, you know, if you like a kind of spy novels, if you have a notion of who a spy is, then the whole bulk or the body of the book is then the search for that person. So similarly, when we have a notion of a particular way of existence has been presented to us. Now we know on some level something is not quite right because we, after all, we're kind of searching a kind of spiritual kind of way out. And whether it is a temporary one through experiencing the kind of comfort or the pleasantry that comes through, you know, doing kind of Tai Chi, yoga or something like that, feeling of kind of healthy, relaxed. But again, that experience doesn't endure, does it? As such, going on to the basal level, the existential level, if we would like then to kind of investigate the nature of our experience, then we need somebody who is going to kind of guide us in that investigation. Just as if we would like to alleviate a particular illness that we're experiencing, then a guide or a doctor in this case is somewhat necessary. And just as we would select a doctor based upon their credentials, and then we would meet the doctor. And if we really disliked them, regardless of the credentials, they would then kind of move away or back away from that person because we really don't trust them. Even though they have their, you know, doctor's degree, they're a doctor of medicine, etc. We don't really fit with that person. If we have any notion that they're a quack, that they're not genuine, then of course it's our right to kind of to back away from. Doesn't mean we need to be rude necessarily, but to back away from that individual. Maybe go to somebody else because we're still feeling ill after all. Or if we go to a doctor, particularly in the kind of homeopathic world, where we kind of go to like a Chinese or a Tibetan doctor, and we go to them again and again, it doesn't work. It doesn't mean that the system is flawed, but maybe that particular doctor isn't one who we can kind of trust or have a relationship of doctor and patient with, and as such we can go to a different doctor. And this is, you know, if I speak a little from my experience, when I was first in India in 1993, then I suffered greatly from kind of nerve disorder, and I went to see the Dalai Lama's physician, who was resident and still is resident in Dharamsala, a guy called Yeshidundan. He's a very, very good doctor. But for me, utterly useless. no matter what medicine he gave, no matter how much acupuncture he did, I was getting more and more ill. And eventually I went to see my teacher, my guru, Demalocha Rinpoche. And Rinpoche said to me, "You look really ill." And I said, "I am really ill." He said, "Why don't you see a doctor then, you idiot?" And I said, "Well, I have been. I've been seeing Yeshu Dundun." He said, "Oh, he's a very good doctor. How long have you been seeing him?" I said, 5 months. He said, "What? The illness you have, it should be kind of cured up in a second. It's not a big illness at all." And so I said, "Well, what, the usual kind of party line? Well, with Tibetan medicine, it takes a long time to be cured, doesn't it?" He said, "Yeah, but not that long." And so then I was introduced to a friend of mine, Lobsang Tenzin, who's also a very, very good doctor. And he did a kind of pulse diagnosis. And he said, yeah. Yeshu Dundun has diagnosed you correctly, but take this medicine instead. And he gave me a different medicine. And within 3 days, I was completely cured. So it can be that there's a particular relationship with the doctor that initially we're not kind of too aware of. Perhaps they kind of present themselves as being kind of very qualified, and perhaps for some people they are qualified. But on the subjective level, maybe we don't really click with that person. So this can evolve. And we can be with that person, learning from them for a while, but we never really click with them. Similarly, it can be then, when we go to see a doctor, me in this instance, with Lobsang Tenzin Rinpoche, within 3 days, then I was completely cured. So that's somebody you click with, isn't it? And similarly, just in day-to-day life, we can meet somebody who we instantly dislike. Somebody who we like but we don't really trust, or that we trust perhaps too quickly and they kind of cheat us. Or somebody who we genuinely kind of click with at the beginning of our relationship. This is just, you know, kind of roundabout talk, isn't it? I mean, it's something that we all know, something that we're all kind of aware of in the kind of, you know, in the existential kind of experiences that we have. We meet these type of people. And why should it be otherwise with a spiritual teacher? As such, we go, for whatever reason, whether it be to kind of gain a winning lottery number, or in a more fundamental and, I would say, genuine kind of Buddhist way, we really would like to do something about this dukkha nature, which is kind of rearing its head within us. We're tired of kind of hitting it down, you know, like that game, you know, this game with the, what do you call it, moles that kind of pop out of the hill, and you hit down with a hammer. You know this one? I see not many of you go to fairgrounds. Or carnivals, I suppose you may say. Anyway, so there's this game where these things come out and you keep whacking it down. So similarly, with the kind of experience of dukkha, it can be that we have these experiences where kind of dukkha, the dukkha nature of things reveals itself. And we kind of push it down because we don't want to acknowledge it. Maybe we feel that something is wrong with us, or you know, maybe our friends tell us there's something that we shouldn't be kind of probing too deeply because it could upset us, and we're kind of pushing these things down, and eventually it just becomes exhausting, and we become overwhelmed by the kind of realization of this dukkha. And as such, we then seek out a method to overcome it. And as such, then the method is something which is given to us by a doctor. And this particular type of doctor is either, you know, a teacher, a spiritual friend, or a guru. And as such, using all the methods that we already know about trusting the person who presents themselves to us, not only like looking at their like credentials, and we're going to come back to this, so please try to keep it in mind, looking at their credentials, and also our kind of feeling, our interaction with that person. Do we really trust them or not? And then the third person that we actually click with on a genuine kind of a level. This is something that we all kind of know about from our experience. And it is also something that pays a kind of a great deal, is very important within then the kind of student, the student or disciple, a relationship with a teacher or a guru. And as such, when we kind of have prepared, you know, or we are kind of prepared to go out and search for a particular teacher, Just as our education system, our common sense, teaches us indirectly that when it comes to selecting a particular teacher, when it comes to kind of the interaction, a doctor, when it comes to the interaction with that person, that all of these things, that openly looking at the qualification of the person, looking at the kind of and investigating the kind of feeling with that person, all of these then come about because of our kind of intelligence, because of our common sense, because of our kind of that which we've kind of brought into kind of from our life, from our what have you. As such, when it comes to the choosing or the seeking out and choosing of a spiritual teacher, all of this needs to be very much within the kind of forefront of our mind. We know, for example, to kind of set the ground, we have an idea of what a doctor of medicine is. We know that only a doctor of medicine is going to be employed by a kind of government clinic, for example. If we know then what the particular qualifications, the letters after the person's name, kind of mean. But also, we're not stupid. We have an education behind us. And as such, if we go to see a kind of doctor, this is like we see in comedy sometimes, we go to see, you know, a quack. He says, "I've got a pain in my elbow." And the doctor says, "Okay, go over there and take your trousers off." It doesn't make any sense, right? But we know that, and it's like, hang on a minute. We can see that in a comedy show, and we'd laugh at it, because it's so ludicrous. How do we know that, when it comes to kind of selecting a spiritual teacher, that we're not walking into a relationship where the prospective spiritual teacher says, you know, when we say, I have this kind of problem, that the teacher is then saying to us, "Oh, you've got a problem with your elbow. Go over there and stand on your head." How do we know that that's not what they're saying to us? So this is why yesterday I was mentioning, it's imperative when coming kind of to the spiritual kind of pursuit, not only to kind of be seeking out a kind of doctor, but also to build up this reserve of kind of common sense. Common sense here then, informed by the teaching of the Buddha in particular, and then the Mahayana, or the particular tradition to which the teacher belongs in specific. So that if we meet by accident a quack, we know instantly that what they are saying doesn't fit with the general kind of presentation of the teaching of the Buddha. And when we know that, when we see that, we know this person's not genuine. He's a quack. Similarly, if we meet somebody who has all the qualifications, when we go to meet that person, they're very cold and aloof, and they don't make us feel as if we're being listened to, or perhaps that they don't really answer our questions, or they're distracted by something, and there's no kind of feeling between the person, we recognize that. We also recognize that the flaw is with the personality and the relationship between ourselves and that particular person. And as such, it's not going to work. And as such, we kind of step back from the person. Maybe we can say, yeah, they're still a good person, but they're not for me. And then there is the third case of when we meet somebody. And here, there is a kind of a subtle or kind of hidden flaw. So when we meet a genuine spiritual teacher for the first time, we can be kind of bowled over by them. We can maybe say, we can perhaps say, "Oh, this person is extraordinary. They're really amazing. Not only do they have all these wonderful letters after their name, not only are they really qualified, they're so warm and charming and helpful." Now, whether that is a genuine feeling of, "I can work with this doctor," whereas in this kind of a scenario, the doctor is very charming, but maybe his understanding of medicine is other than it should be. Maybe there's an ulterior motivation. Maybe it's monetary, maybe it's other than that. Similarly, maybe he's very charming and speaks very well, but there's no substance to what he says. Or maybe there is kind of charm, there is kind of the ability to communicate well, and there is the quality of medicine, there is the quality of being able to administer cures, and there is the quality of being able to give that which alleviates the pain of the student. As such, here in the third category, as a student, if one is so kind of in awe of the personality of the teacher, we can maybe forget to take the medicine, or we just get charmed by going to see the doctor again and again. But ultimately, this is not, going back to our default position, the reason we came to the doctor in the first place is to overcome this dukkha nature, to overcome this dukkha experience. That's forgotten, and we just get caught up in the charm of the personality of the doctor. So as such, how to avoid that is having then this understanding of the dukkha nature based upon one's experience, and then going to the doctor as the, or the teacher, as that, as as that person who's going to alleviate that particular dissatisfaction, and not wishing to kind of move from that experience. As such, then one doesn't get kind of overly charmed by the teacher, and as such one is given the genuine kind of medicine by a very charming, genuine doctor, spiritual teacher, if you will, and one partakes of that. Because a genuine spiritual teacher, the only thing that they want is for you to get better, nothing else. And of course, I mean, as I saw a film about one really great teacher called Dzongsa Kenzin Rinpoche. And Rinpoche, in the film, is called The Words of My Perfect Teacher, if you'd like to see it. In there, he's Bhutanese. He kind of talks about his frustration at Bhutanese people, because they view him or revere him like a deity, and nobody would dare even to speak to him. And so he says, my job is to be like a doctor. You know, I've got all these panacea to alleviate kind of suffering, and I'm supposed to be a doctor to all these people. But how can I be so? How can I be so when they won't even talk to me about their particular ailment? And as such, through that kind of cultural baggage, there is this kind of there is this condition which renders then the would-be relationship somewhat invalid. So as such, when we approach a spiritual teacher, there should be a reason, and that reason should endure throughout the relationship with the teacher. I'll pause here for 5-10 minutes for the bathroom. So having reflected upon or one's experience, or having been introduced to a particular book and reading about it and causing some kind of inner contemplation about one's existential experience, there within having an idea that everything is dukkha, and then wishing to achieve that which is then the exhaustion or the thorough removal of dukkha, which is known as nirvana, have this experience for oneself, then if one would like that, one has the kind of grounding, as I mentioned then, in being aware enough of the general and specific teaching of the Mahayana presentation of Buddhism as presented in their different traditions or through different kind of clarifications. And then the idea is to make sense of this, or to be able to really digest it. And as such, one needs the kind of actimel, if you will, that helps one kind of digest, which is then the spiritual teacher. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that, for example, when we initially approach kind of a teacher, maybe we have the idea that we're just a little bit ill, but through our kind of discussion with a teacher, we then realize or come to know that we are really kind of not just a little bit ill, but rather we are very ill. But what we want to do about that, again, is very subjective. Maybe we would like to kind of rid ourselves of it in as quick a way as possible. Maybe we're not really that bothered. We just want to get rid of a bit of it so that we can, you know, get, you know, for example, we may, you know, not want to go through the whole rigmarole of an operation and this or that. We say to the doctor, just get me through the next, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours because I need to do something, etc. Give me a temporary fix, etc. So again, all of this is subjective. Just because the teacher knows how to completely cure you of your illness doesn't necessarily mean that you would want to go through the rigmarole of that process. But with regard then to the actual practice, it's the doctor's job, duty in fact, part of the Hippocratic Oath, that you have to reveal the nature of the illness to the patient. And as such, when understanding then something which hitherto was just simply hearsay, something you'd understood from the pages of a book, or maybe from a discussion with a friend, when then, when meeting with a kind of genuine spiritual teacher, it's their job to then reveal the kind of nature of dukkha in all its manifold aspects as soon as possible. That doesn't mean at the first meeting necessarily. It all depends on the relationship between the teacher and the student. Because as I mentioned yesterday, the relationship begins by the student meeting a prospective student meeting a prospective teacher and then requesting that the relationship begin. And then the relationship, like any relationship, is two-way. It comes through then interacting with the teacher. As such, then, this is a kind of like, you know, a marriage in some ways, like a partnership. You get to know the person, you kind of go out on a date or two, and then realize that this is the person, you know, I think they use the word soulmate these days, so that's your kind of soulmate, and then you work at remaining with that person. And it's not always a kind of a smooth ride, it can be quite bumpy at times, but there should be then the connection between you and the teacher that endures, the kind of loving connection of somebody from a disciple side who's open to what the teacher says, and the loving kind of concern and compassion from the teacher's side, wishing to then free the student from their particular predicament of dukkha. Now, as I've been mentioning, when we experience dukkha, this arises unique to our circumstance, but that which causes all of its arisal is what we'll call then our kind of staunch adherence to our personality, which is sometimes known as an ego. And this arises in various forms, and this is then the cause of all emotion, which in turn then is the cause of all action, which then is experienced as a fruition. In other words, this ego is the core, and our addiction or clinging to this is that which brings about action or karma, which is, if brought about under the influence of this seemingly autonomous I or personality, seemingly kind of concrete personality, that then is the contaminant. So anything that we experience on a causal level, that is to say engaging in a particular action, which is contaminated, and the fruition thereof, is also contaminated. So as such, when one looks objectively at the makeup of samsara, through understanding then how one goes into and comes out of samsara through reflecting upon these 12 links of mutual dependence, one then understands how one builds one's own kind of experience, how one builds one's own kind of samsara, and how simply by applying the techniques of a spiritual teacher, one can reverse that, and thereby reverse then the experience of dukkha. So it's a teacher's job then to be able to identify from within the kind of mass of experience that is ourselves, to identify then the root cause, this addiction to something which isn't there, this seeming autonomous existence. And then uses a variety of methods to kind of sever that or to cut that. And these can be both peaceful and also can be at times quite shocking, quite outrageous. But here, if there's a genuine kind of a relationship, then whether the instruction is kind of given peacefully or it's given quite forcefully, it makes no difference, because from the student's perspective, it's all a way of curing one of this dukkha. And also from the teacher's side, from the guru's side, it's all a method of removing this kind of basal kind of problem, which is then the cause, or that which proliferates, the contaminant, which brings about then cyclic existence. Now this relationship then, for this to kind of occur in a genuine way, of course, if we relate it back to our example of the doctor, now the doctor can simply, you know, give us, you know, a drink. He can put some medicine in the drink, and it can, you know, like Alka-Seltzer, it can kind of fizz out, and maybe have a nice orange taste. It's quite pleasant. And then maybe as he investigates us and investigates the causes of our illness more, it's not just the case of having a headache. Maybe the headache isn't going away, and then maybe he needs to kind of give us, you know, take some blood. So he sticks a needle in our arm. He stabs us. But again, the motivation is to draw blood to investigate the illness. And as such, we understand that motivation. We understand the reasons behind the doctor's activity. And as such, we allow him to stab us with a needle and pull out some blood. If, let's say, the blood work results in kind of revealing a particular kind of cancer, then maybe we need to have the unpleasantness of being kind of locked in a metal tube and having kind of magnetic waves kind of blasted at us, some kind of MRI scan. And again, the teacher has taken us, he's locked us in, like in the trunk of a car, and he's kind of bombarded us with kind of noise and various waves, etc. And we're quite happy to endure that because we see the benefit of it. And then let's say he identifies a particular tumour, then we give the doctor the permission to cut us open and to remove parts of our body, maybe 2-3 times. But we understand that this is part of the process of healing, ultimately. And as such, we're quite happy to engage in that particular scenario. Now, all of this is possible because we trust the doctor, we trust the people the doctor trusts, we trust the machinery and the mechanics of the way of curing us. And as such, because this is unique to us, we don't get upset and say, oh, you're kind of cutting me open, but no, my friend over there, you only gave him an injection. How come I don't get just an injection? How come I have to go through this rigmarole? It's because of the differing illness and the differing method in dealing with that particular kind of illness. So as I mentioned, this trust which comes then between the patient and the doctor is something which has as its fallback position our kind of intellect and our intelligence. We know what the meaning of the word, the initials after the doctor is. We know what a doctor of medicine is. We trust in my case, the National Health or the private clinic that we're affiliated towards or with. They're going to give us the best treatment. We click with the doctor. We've known them, you know, for a little while. We have a rapport with them. You know, we're on a first name kind of basis, if you like. And so we trust them completely to get rid of our illness. It's their job. Similarly then, the job of a spiritual teacher on a variety of levels is to remove then the contaminator, which is this addiction to a seeming autonomous existence, which is the cause of all of the dukkha experience. Now remember when the Buddha said, everything is dukkha, and this has a cause. So the cause there is the misunderstanding or the confusion about reality, an addiction towards that misunderstanding, which proliferates into action. That action then in turn leads to what is known as kind of karma. And then the result of that, the result when it manifests, is right from the basis, it's contaminated. For example, if you have people kind of play with flowers, I don't know in Israel, but particularly in Japan, they kind of like to kind of have things in different colors. So what you can do is get a white flower, like a lily, and then you only let it feed on, or let it drink kind of water which is dyed blue. And then the flower becomes, you know, blue or pink or yellow or green or a variety of colors, because you've dyed it a particular color. Similarly then, the dye is the cause of the flower looking kind of blue. Similarly then, the contaminant, which is then this misunderstanding of existence, thinking that something exists in and of itself when it's rather other than that, and primarily our addiction to that through repeated habituation, is that which propels emotion. Particularly then kind of wanting something, not wanting something else, or as they're commonly known, overt addiction and kind of hostility, pushing that away. And then these spiral out into various other types of kind of emotion, all of which give rise to, when entertained by ourselves, particular type of action, which bring about particular type of dukkha result. And so it's the dye that causes then the flower to be blue. Similarly, it's this misunderstanding or this initial confusion which causes all of our experience to be in the nature of dukkha, or ultimate, unable to deliver lasting satisfaction. So if we want to, our being, our mind primarily, is not inherently dukkha. For if that were the case, we wouldn't be able to do anything about it. But rather, when we understand, like the lily flowers, if we understand that they are naturally white, not blue, then if we remove the blue water, then we can take the blueness out of the flower. So it's just the same then with the person who removes the blue dye, whether he kind of just takes it away gently or whether he knocks it away. In both cases, he or she is removing then this contaminant, this artificial contaminant. Similarly then, the spiritual teacher, his or her job in a genuine case, is to assess the teacher, to assess the student, to get to know them, and then slowly diagnose the person, and then utilize methods which are unique to a particular person in order to remove their the contaminant which causes their dukkha nature. So this then is the job of a genuine teacher. As such, when we go to the teacher then, initially there should be this desire or wish to become free of this dukkha nature. We also have then the knowledge or the information, so as when the respective spiritual teacher interacts with us, we know that what they're saying is correct, and we have a kind of good feeling for that person, and as such then slowly the relationship kind of begins. And the relationship revolves around, as I mentioned, the genuine spiritual guide or spiritual teacher only wishes, like a doctor, genuine doctor, only wishes for the patient to be better. Similarly then, the spiritual doctor only wishes for his or her students to get better. That is to say, to rid themselves of the contaminant that is the cause then of this dukkha experience. And as such, thus the relationship between the student and the disciple is born. Now, as I mentioned, this can, within the kind of Buddhist context, we can talk of varying types of methods which are used. And if we consider them, there are three general spiritual approaches or vehicles. The word vehicle is used because it's that which carries one from A to B, literally. So we can talk of the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana ways or methods. And when we relate to a particular spiritual teacher within these yanas, if we look at them each on their own ground to start with, then we will understand that particular kind of relationship. Just as we may, for example, have a very nice doctor who refers us to a GP, who's a specialist in a particular field, who may then refer your case to somebody who's then a kind of master of cardiology, for example. He's a leading cardiologist, but he is able then to do the function of a GP, of a referent doctor, and also as a cardiologist. Whereas maybe just a GP on his own isn't able to do that, or maybe just a kind of general kind of hospital doctor may be able to do the job of a GP and also as a general kind of resident doctor in a hospital, but isn't a specialist. So these are then GP, kind of a GP, and then the middle one is then a kind of a resident doctor, and then there is a specialist. So if we relate these three doctors then to the Hinayana, to the Mahayana, and then the Vajrayana approach, then this will give us some notion of how the spiritual teacher can function within the particular kind of arena that they're given to function in. So with regard to the Hinayana, in this spiritual pursuit, the aim of the patient is for what you might call a quick-term fix. They're not really interested in thoroughly eradicating or removing the dukkha nature, but rather in just kind of getting rid of the gross kind of proliferation thereof, and then just with the cause of it, just kind of leaving it to one side for the moment. Within this tradition, the most important person for one's spiritual development is a teacher whose aspect is as the person who gives monastic ordination, who is then one's abbot or one's kind of master. And in terms of kind of meditation, it's this abbot that one turns to primarily, or at least an elder monastic, for within the Theravada tradition, then the monastic form of Buddhism is given kind of precedence. One's abbot then, or meditation teacher, gives one then the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the 12 Links, and so forth. And in dependence upon that, one experiences then the result of living in monastic ordination, or living within then the kind of, at least on a basal level, the kind of precepts of a householder. This individual then, to serve as an abbot, one needs to have been an ordained monastic for over 10 or 15 years. And at best, that individual has spiritual realization such that they have an understanding of this kind of false kind of presentation of autonomous existence. They understand the illusory nature of that. But all that this individual is able to do is offer then the method which brings about a kind of temporary kind of suppression, if you will, or temporary kind of removal of the gross experiences of dukkha, but is unable to give the methods which remove then the subtle kind of dukkha. So the example given between this doctor and the Mahayana doctor is the first case, if we relate it to a perfume, perfume in a bottle or in a cup. This first person is able to pour the perfume out of the cup, give it a rinse around, but the smell of the perfume he's unable to eradicate from the bottle or from the cup. So the spiritual master, in this case, is relied on as an abbot. From within the three jewels, the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, he's relied upon as a Sangha member. For within the Theravada presentation, as you see in Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma and so forth, then the monastic Sangha is held in the highest esteem. Not the Buddha, because the Buddha has passed away. Not the Dhamma, because Dhamma is just words. But rather the Sangha, because they are the ones who then carry on the kind of tradition, if you will, of the Buddha, of practicing the Dhamma. So the Sangha is then the main kind of object of refuge. Now if we look at the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, so this is where we can talk about Hinayana and Mahayana, Hina meaning kind of lesser and Maha meaning kind of greater, in terms of motivation, whereas the lesser motivation is just to kind of give oneself a kind of temporary rest from contaminated existence, whereas the greater viewpoint is not only to give oneself such a rest, but is also to give each and every sentient being that same experience. How? By becoming Buddha oneself. Within this tradition, one understands that the nature of one's consciousness or mind is not dukkha, but rather is when all the dukkha, not only the gross perfume, but the subtle stain or smell left thereby, when all of that is removed, then one's experience is that of full awakening, which is another word of which is another way of saying Buddha, which is another way of saying the great nirvana. This is one's nature, and as such, to leave this kind of subtle stain or scent within the bottle is tantamount then to cutting oneself short. It's like, for example, if one has a strong cancer, one not only has an operation to remove the cancerous and the flesh, but also uses chemo and radiotherapy to thoroughly eradicate any traces of it. One understands then, by having a particular, for example, a lymph gland removed, one understands that the kind of gross cancer is gone or is removed. However, there may still be cancerous cells that have broken loose and are floating around one's being, ready to bring about further dissatisfaction. So as such, to regale and not have the chemotherapy or the radiotherapy would then be like, would tantamount to kind of wishing for more operations in the future. So the Mahayanist then, the motivation is not only to get rid of the gross kind of experience, but also to get rid of the very origin of it. And such is their motivation. There within, the spiritual friend is related to as both an abbot and a teacher. Abbot in the sense of not giving monastic ordination, but rather giving the twofold precept of the Mahayana path, spiritual path, which is known as the path of the Bodhisattva. So in order to follow then the path of the Bodhisattva, one needs to initially give rise to the idea of bodhicitta, that is to say, the desire or the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. And when one gives rise to this, there are certain kind of precepts or certain vows that one takes. And the reason for this is to hold one in a particular routine. It's like, for example, if you have a problem with your liver, the doctor then says to you, or kind of, you must not take kind of fried food, fatty food, heavy food, because it will not only kind of enrage the kind of liver, but any kind of benefit that's come through the medicine I've given you will be kind of wiped out. So you're given a kind of vow or restraint. The restriction is then put on that which would upset the liver, because that is then the organ which is failing you and that which you need to protect. Similarly, when one initially gives rise then to this idea of becoming Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings, now this is a fickle idea at first. It's something which is not strongly born within us, and we need to protect it. As such then, the kind of vows and restraints are received from a teacher, who in turn has received them from his or her teacher. And one practices these, practices abiding in this. And it may be a little bit uncomfortable at first, a little bit shaky, little bit artificial, a little bit false, if you like. But through familiarity, one becomes familiar with this, cultivating this attitude again and again, and abiding within this kind of way of life. And thereby, one is able to then make kind of progress on this particular kind of route, or on this particular kind of spiritual path. The teacher then is seen as a person who embodies the twofold bodhicitta, and is one who then instructs one in the practices that should be engaged in, not only then the vows which hold this attitude within one's kind of being, but also then the practices such as the six perfect actions and the four means of gathering disciples and so forth. The teacher, being the embodiment of the Dharma of these instructions, then is related to as the full embodiment of the Dharma, and as such is related to as the Dharma, as embodying the Dharma. Here then, the of the three jewels, the main kind of jewel which is relied upon is the Dharma, which is transmitted then through then the master, or through the teacher. Lastly then, to the kind of Vajrayana. Now the Vajrayana is simply a branch of the Mahayana. It is not other than the Mahayana. As such then, the Vajrayana brings about then the state of this kind of complete purification of our kind of cup and perfume. So far in the Hinayana tradition, it's as if we've tipped the perfume out of its container, and we've kind of rinsed it around, but it still smells of perfume. But that's okay, because the bulk of the liquid has gone. In the Mahayana, one scrubs at the container, washing it again and again and again, and it takes a really long time, scrubbing again and again and again, trying to get the smell out of the glass. Whereas in the Vajrayana, at one time, the person kind of pours the perfume out, and then puts the container with some very strong soap powder in kind of a dishwasher, which has this incredible kind of strong kind of cleansing kind of liquid, which is in half an hour able to completely remove any kind of trace smell of that perfume. So the result of the Mahayana and the Vajrayana is the same, but the duration or the time which is spent at this purification of the kind of subtle stain which is left through then removing the gross perfume is, in terms of time, extremely different. As such, the Vajrayana then is the practice or the vehicle which has these variety of methods which bring about, of course, the same result as the Mahayana, but within a very short space of time. And within this practice, what one brings about is then the kind of resultant state of the ultimate nirvana or awakening, through then receiving a particular meditation scenario from a teacher, meditation method which is given through the medium of something which is known as empowerment. So empowerment here, sometimes translated as initiation. Initiation is a wrong translation. Here, one is empowered just as, for example, in countries which have a monarchy, then the kind of outgoing kind of monarch empowers his or her heir as then the ruler of the country. So, for example, in England, we now have Queen Elizabeth, and she was empowered by her father as the Queen. And she is empowered to perform the activities of the Queen. Now her eldest son, the successor to the throne, Charles, he's a prince, but he's not king. Why is he not king? He's not king because he hasn't been empowered as a king, because somebody hasn't empowered him as such. You can say, well, as soon as his mother dies, then he's king. It's not the case. If his mother was to die tomorrow, then there's the whole kind of putting together of the ceremony whereby he's enthroned and invested as the king. So similarly, in terms of the empowerment which one receives from a teacher, what is done at that time is the teacher then, with the utter skill of a kind of champion physician, of like a brain surgeon, draws out then the awakened nature from within one so that one can experience it very, very quickly. As such, the master of the Vajrayana, or the guru, is viewed as a guru in this case. In the former Hinayana case, he's referred to as an abbot. In the Mahayana case, as a spiritual friend. But in the Vajrayana, then he is definitely a guru, because this individual is manifesting through their being the actual kind of Buddha nature, which we all have, and is symbolically giving us the method from which we can draw that out from within ourselves. As such, the teacher or the guru of Vajrayana is somebody who not only has experience of the various practices within Vajrayana, such as the development and completion stage, but has the ability then to pass this on through his or her realization. And such a teacher then is related to as the Buddha in person. Okay, so I'll finish here, otherwise I'll get in trouble with the boss again. So we'll continue again at 4 o'clock. Four o'clock, yeah? Anyway, if I'm late, it doesn't matter. Jambarabhava.